Would you turn, please, to Genesis chapter 1. In getting the benefit out of a book like Hosea, what you have to do is interpret it two ways. And these are very basic rules for books that otherwise won't really speak to you. Way number one, interpret it in the light of the understanding of the original hearers. Okay? Because they approached it with a particular economic, geographic, spiritual background that you and I don't have. And unless we can see it the way they saw it, we won't understand what it's about at all. So we've got to look at it through the eyes of the original hearers. Okay, then number two, principle number two, is you interpret it in the light of the New Testament. Otherwise it will just be Old Testament stuff and you won't think it applies to your life at all. And it does. It has very, very radical, far-reaching, marvelous implications for your life and mine. But unless we look at it in the light of New Testament truth, it won't appear to be so. So those are the basic rules for the interpreting of a book like Hosea. Now, Genesis chapter 1, if you'll follow along, I'll just read. In the beginning there was man, thinking, laughing, smoking, stronger than dirt. He decided that it was he who created the heavens and the earth and the host therein. And man said, let there be light. And it was so. Neon light, fluorescent light, flashlight, spotlight, laser light, mercury vapor light, General Electric, Sylvania and Westinghouse, all blinking on and off at the will of man. And man saw the abundant light and said to the host assembled in awe, live better electrically. And man called the light power and he called the dark power outage. And then man said, let the earth bring forth green things. And it was so, for man tilled the ground and seeded the clouds. And man beheld the great bumper crops which he had made. He said, ho, 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 I am the jolly green giant. And it was good. And man split the atom, assembled the computers and conquered the heavens. And man called the heavens space, and he called the earth ground control. And man gazed into space, saying, let there be voices to sing my praises. And it was so, for there became Telstar, Early Bird, Comsat, and Lunar Orbiter. And man heard the voices that he had made, and he nodded, A-okay. Then man said, let us make God in our own image after our likeness, and let him have dominion over 1 hour on Sunday morning. And it was so. And God was made quite a lot like a doting father, and definitely on our side. Man congratulated himself for his success and wisdom in all things. In fact, he drank a toast from his thermos, put God on a shelf, returned to his own ways, and blew himself up. And in the end, there was God, whose sigh was too deep for word. The very opening statement of Genesis is diametrically opposed to the way most human beings look at the world, the universe, and themselves in particular. In the beginning, God. And we have to learn to look at everything from God's point of view, because that's where it begins. It isn't what we think and what we want and what's beneficial for us in our thinking that counts, because he is the originator, and it's what he thinks and he wants and what's beneficial to him that's really important. So in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And what he was doing was he was producing a work of art. The heavens and the earth are very beautiful, very ordered. And as we look at them, they convey a message. When an artist sets out to produce a work of art, he usually does two things. First of all, he copies something that's already there. Second, he puts into his work something of his own particular insight, vision, ability as an artist, and he expresses himself. When God was about his work of art in creation, he only did one of those two things. He didn't copy what was already there for a very good reason. There was nothing there to be copied. So he was doing the other thing, he was expressing himself. And at creation, there was no such thing before as sound. And no such thing as sound waves or ears. There was no such thing as light and color. They were his ideas. There was no such thing as taste, flavor, or food. He designed both the flavors and the taste buds to appreciate them. And to pull out ideas like this out of nothing, it's interesting. We've got five senses. Suppose we were to have a genuine sixth one, not the so-called sixth sense that we have. What would it be? What would you call it? How would you experience it? We're limited to thinking in terms of five senses because that's what God thought up. They were his ideas. What are yours? And as God is creating, he is expressing himself. That's why everything he made, he took a look at it and he said, hey, that's good. Because the definition of what's good is it's like God. It's not like God. It's not good. I know, for instance, people who say they have a good time. I know a man who says he has a good time beating up his wife. He doesn't. He has an enjoyable time beating up his wife. He doesn't have a good time because it's not a good thing to do. I know other people who talk about a good time on Saturday night. What do they mean? They mean a bad time, right? Because they're doing something that's bad. It's not good. Nothing good about it. Something's only good if it's like God. That's the definition of what's good. That's why when a lawyer came up to Jesus Christ and said, good master, he said, hang on right there. Who are you calling good? Don't you know there's only one who's good? That's God. Is that what you mean? And as God created, everything he created was good. Now, suppose you were to go for a walk along a beach. And since you've been badly behaved in the Bible school and we're trying to decide on a new punishment, we send you with a bucket about this size. And you've got to fill it up with grains of sand from the beach. Bring it back here, spread it out on a huge sheet of white plastic and count how many grains of sand there are. How many grains of sand do you think there would be in a bucket full? Well, however many you think, it's probably enough to make you wish you hadn't done whatever it was. Suppose though we asked you to count how many grains of sand on the whole beach. And then to take a little trip right around the coast of North America, Florida and California and all these other places and see how many grains of sand there are all the way around. Then we'll throw in Africa and Europe and Russia and China and Australia. How many grains of sand do you think there might be in all that? Let's call it G. That's for grains of sand. And that's approximately how many stars there are. No one knows to within a few million how many grains of sand there are or how many stars there are. But the two numbers are about the same order. Then, what size is a star? Well, if you had a basketball and you had a whole pile of pinheads and you stuffed as many pinheads inside the basketball as you could, how many pinheads do you think you get in there? However many you think it is, we'll call it P. P for pinheads. All right? not students, Pinheads. S for students. Well, the sun is that many times bigger than the earth. Okay. And the average star is three times that. The sun is a kind of small, undernourished sort of a star. How far apart are they? Well, if you get your basketball hanging up in space, maybe we make a model inside here, okay? So we hang the basketball up here, and then we've got a pinhead which represents the Earth. Now, where are we going to hang the pinhead relative to the basketball? Over here? Over by the door there? Actually, 100 yards away. And that gets the proportion right. Okay, basketball, 100 yards, pinhead. Now then, suppose we are sitting in an atom bomb just now, and it is, if you could have one, a perfect atom bomb. And inside this atom bomb, there's just about that much fuel. Explosive, 1 gram. According to Einstein, who was a relatively bright gentleman, E equals mc squared. C being what? Speed of light. Okay, what's that in numbers? 186,000 miles per second or 300,000 kilometers per second. Now, kilometers is the wrong unit. We need centimeters. How do we change kilometers to centimeters? Well, if we multiply by 1,000, that will bring us down to meters. By 100 will bring us to centimeters squared. Well, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 zeros. Squared comes to 20 zeros. 3 squared is 9. 9 with 20 zeros, that's 900 million, million, million. Agreed? M, the mass, equals 1. Energy then, in our little atom bomb, only a little one, 1 gram of fuel in the atom bomb, when it explodes, the fuel disappears. 1 gram disappears. What's left? 900 million, million, million units of energy. Mm-hmm. What's that called? Dangerous. That's why we're just discussing it and not actually doing it. Now, there's nothing on Einstein's theory to say you can't do it the opposite way around. So we start in a little space here with absolutely nothing. We focus in lots and lots of energy, electromagnetic waves and all kinds of stuff. And out of nothing we produce a gram of material. How much energy do we need to do that? Well, if we don't waste any at all, and it's an absolutely 100% efficient system, we will need 900 million, million, million units of energy to produce out of nothing 1 gram of substance. That's not very impressive, is it? Suppose we wanted to make the Earth out of nothing. How much energy would we need? Well, we need the amount we need to make that multiplied by the number of times that will fit into the Earth. How many times will that fit into the Earth? Well, how many times will it fit into this room, for starters? Okay, now how many times will it fit into Texas? Texas isn't quite as big as the rest of the world put together, no matter what Texans may give you to understand. So, however many times you think that would fit into the Earth, We'll call that E, okay? Shall we? No, we'll call it W for world. So the amount of energy required to produce the world out of nothing would be 900 million, million, million times W. The number of times that will fit into the earth. But suppose we would like to make the sun instead. I mean, the sun's a bit more impressive than the earth. The earth's pretty puny. How much energy would we need to create the sun out of nothing? Well, you just multiply that by P. You see, the number of pinheads you can get in a basketball. Of course, if you'd like to make an average star, then you need to multiply that one again by 3. Now, if you'd like to make the universe, all you need to do is multiply that again by G, the number of grains of sand on all the beaches and on all the seashores in the earth. And that's a little mathematical statement, rather vague, of how much energy it requires to produce the universe out of nothing. That's what the scientists mean when they talk about the Big Bang Theory. That's how big the bang was. If, on the other hand, we're talking about God creating the heavens and the earth out of nothing, that's a minimum statement of the energy required. Now, suppose we gave you a little job, and that was to go down to the beach and not only count the number of grains of sand on the beach, but give a different name to every grain. And then, having taken a little stroll the whole length of the beach, we invite you to stroll back again and pick out any grain that's been moved. Okay. Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Reference there is Isaiah, actually Isaiah, but for the sake of communication, Isaiah chapter 40, verses 25 and 26. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he was expressing himself. And the highlight of his creation was not the stars, was not the Milky Way, was not Saturn or Venus or Jupiter, wasn't the Alps or the Rockies or the Pacific. The highlight of his creation was man. He created a man and a woman, and then he said, "Very good." Then we have a problem. If something is only good if it's like God, how can anything ever be very good? Well, the mountains tell us one thing about God, perhaps his permanent lasting strength. The sunlight tells us something else, his radiance, purity. The ocean tells us something else, his sort of limitlessness. And man was designed to tell everything about God. So all that God is would be expressed by the life of the man and the woman together. That's why it's described as being very good. The whole story. Now I need to take you back into some ancient history. About 200 years, all the way back to when I was a mere 17. Not quite 200 years, but it's getting on that way. And right back then, I had a friend at school who had never, in the whole of his life, ever had a girlfriend or even so much as a date. His name's Graham. And he was worried about never having had a date, so he came to see me to see if I couldn't help him to organize one. I said, "I don't know, Graham. These things are not always easy to organize, but I will do what I can." Just leave it with me. And when I thought about it, I remembered a very attractive girl by name of Pam. Sorry, Pam. But that was her name. And Pam had just had a huge argument with her boyfriend, Brian. And they weren't on speaking terms anymore, which was very sad because they still liked each other a lot. But neither would be the first one to come back and say, hey, I'm sorry. So I went round to see Pam, and I invited her to come with me down to the fairground. And on the way down to the fairground, I started to tell her about Graham. And I said, you know Graham, don't you? And she said, Graham? What about Graham? Well, do you know he's never had a date? No, she said, I'm sure he hasn't. And I said, yeah, I know what you're saying. You think he's weird. Actually, he's not weird. He's just shy. But he's so shy that he appears to be weird when somebody like you talks to him. But if you get to know him underneath the shyness, he's really very nice. Is he? She said. Yes, he is. And what has that got to do with me? Well, Pam, you remember those evenings you used to spend with Brian, those long evenings? And she said, yeah. Well, you don't spend them with Brian now, so you must have all that time to spare. And if you've got all that time to spare, it wouldn't hurt you to spend one evening with Graham, would it? Wouldn't hurt me, she said, but why should I? I said, well, think, Pam, just suppose that you spend one evening with Graham, just one, and there's only two of you, nobody else sees you, and yet Brian learns about it by some amazing stretch of coincidence. Not like if I tell him. He might get worried that he really is going to lose you, and that might just be the very thing that he needs to stimulate him to come back to you and take you out himself. Hey, she said, that might work. Let's try that one. So I made an arrangement with Pam that she'd be waiting on the steps of the town hall at 7:30 on the Saturday evening. And then we got down to the fairground. We had a ball down at the fairground. We went on the roller coaster and the waltzing Matilda and all the other machines designed to make you sick in as short a space of time as possible. Until we found some of these mirrors with kind of wriggly glass in them. You know the kind, don't you? They make you look peculiar. Unless, of course, you look peculiar to begin with, in which case you might find one that will help you. Anyway, Pam was kind enough to stand beside the mirror while I took a photograph by pointing my camera into the mirror. Then I took her back home, went home myself and called Graham, told him he had a date for 7:30, Saturday night, town hall steps, a girl he'd never met called Pam. Graham was all excited. Put down the telephone, went upstairs, took the film out of my camera and developed it. And it was magnificent. She had one eye up here, one eye down here, and sort of lumps everywhere except where you could reasonably expect them to be. And I trimmed around the edge of my photograph, so I took the frame off the mirror, and I was left with what appeared to be a genuine photograph of a slightly unusual-looking female. Saturday evening, I went to Graham's home about 6:30. He was getting all ready to go out on his very first date. It was back in the days of the Teddy Boys when they wore blue suede shoes like Elvis Presley would sing about. And guys then used to slick their hair down with some sort of white axle grease called Brill Cream, it was called. You can see what it does for you long term. It's really not to be recommended. Anyway, he did all this. He even went to the extraordinary lengths of cleaning his teeth, which, made a wonderful difference to him. they were green and not, white, not green as we'd all supposed till then. And when he was actually ready, I said, "Graham, you'll want to be able to recognize him, won't you?" "Yes," he said. What does she look like?" "Well, it so happens, Graham, that I have a photograph." I produced my lovely photograph and offered it to him, and he took it all eagerly and looked at it, tried it the other way up. Then he went sort of pink and angry looking, and he said, "What is that? I asked you for a girl, not a Martian. Where did you find that thing?" "Listen, Graham," I said, "beggars can't always choose, you know." "And Bridget Bardot happens to be busy on Saturday. However, this girl isn't." "Granted, she doesn't look like Bridget Bardot. But she does have a lot of friends, and they all know she's having a date with you. And if you don't turn up, or if you don't behave really well towards her and give her a good evening, then your name will be mud throughout the school and never be able to help you again. On the other hand, if she has a really good time and tells all these friends she's got what a great guy you are, then you'll be the hero of the school and you'll be able to have your pick of the school, won't you? But it's all up to you. You must go and you must be good to her." Well, in the end, Graham went muttering all kinds of horrible threats about what he was going to do to me on the Monday. Arrived at 7:25 on the steps of the town hall, looking very half-heartedly and very unenthusiastically for an approaching creature from Mars. Pam, meanwhile, was on the other side of the road watching Graham, smiling to herself. He was nervous, kept looking at his watch. 8:30, still no Martians, only Earthlings. 25 to 8. It had still not arrived. Well, if it couldn't get here by this time, that was its problem. He was going home. And he set off down the steps to go home. Pam came across the road and met him at the bottom of the steps, smiled nicely at him and said, "Hello, Graham, I'm Pam." And she really was extremely attractive. And Graham's eyes opened. And his mouth fell open. It's a good thing he had cleaned his teeth. And then, after a minute, he managed to gasp out, "But you can't be." And she said, "Really, why?" "Well, you're nice." "Of course I'm nice. What did you expect, a monster?" And just as he was trying to talk his way out of that one, Pam started laughing at him, and she said, "Ken didn't by any chance give you a photograph, did he?" Boy, did he give me a photograph. And I'm telling you this rubbish because there is somebody extremely brilliant in the business of giving out not a photograph, but a horrible, ugly, twisted mental picture of the most important person in your existence, and that's your guy. And every one of us suffers to some degree from his activities. Every one of us has a picture of God that is too small, too distorted, too unworthy, which is why we behave toward him the way we do. It's not the truth, but it's the picture we've got. He got busy in the Garden of Eden. He did that to Eve. What he said to Eve was this: one, God is boring. There's no real adventure. There's no real thrill. There's no real excitement staying in his will. You'll only enjoy any kind of real life when you throw over the shackles and you do your own thing. Please yourself. Second, God is a liar. He said you'll die if you do, you won't. In fact, he knows you won't. He knows that life for you will become much broader. You'll be like God yourselves. Instead of miserable, crawling around little yes people. Assert yourself. So she did. And she believed all those lies about God. And the human race has believed them ever since. That's why quite often you don't really trust God, because you think you know better. It is crazy, but you think you know better. Could you give a name to all those grains of sand? Could you? Yet you think you know better. You don't even understand how your own body works, but you think you know better than the creator of your body. And the person who distorted the picture that Eve had, had nothing to offer. He didn't offer one single thing, because he didn't create one single thing. All he wanted to do was to make her prostitute the gifts that God himself had given. And she did. And so man ceased to be in the likeness of God. And God has been concerned ever since to reestablish his likeness in the earth. Man became so sick and distorted that God had a look at mankind in Genesis 6, and he said, "Yuck!" If you can imagine God being as undignified as that, he quite often is, actually. He's more interested in communication than he is in the nicety of manner sometimes. And sometimes you've got to say something fairly shocking to get through to certain kinds of people. So God had a look at mankind, he said, "Yuck!" Of course, if you think he speaks in 17th century English, then God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And God said, "It repents me that I've created man. I will now destroy man from off the face of the earth." I didn't think we had time to say that. "Yuck!" is a little bit more precise, and it's saying about the same thing. "Yep, let's wipe man out," he said. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and he landed high and dry. And God continued his plans through Noah, and then on beyond Noah with Abraham. Then with Abraham's son, what was his name? Abraham's son, Isaac. And then his grandson, what was his name? Jacob. And Jacob had his name changed to Israel. Okay, and Israel had how many sons? 12. So, Jacob, whose name is Israel, has 12 sons. He has, in fact, 11 sons plus Joseph, who left and went to Egypt. And the sons of Israel, or the nation of Israel as they've become, were chosen to do two things. First of all, to know what God is like, and second, to reveal what he's like. To know what he's like and to show what he's like. Now Joseph, you won't find a tribe called Joseph, but he had two sons. One was called Ephraim, and the other was called Manasseh. And 11 plus Ephraim and Manasseh equals 13. There are in fact 13 tribes of Israel rather than 12. Out of those 13, there was a tribe of Levi plus 12 others. Levi never owned any territory. God was planning to give them a land called Canaan. he showed it to Abraham, but he told Abraham that he couldn't take possession of it. The reference is Genesis 15, though we'll not look it up. He told Abraham that his descendants would own it, that before they would own it, they would be slaves for 400 years in another land. The reason given was that the Canaanite tribes were not entirely evil in Abraham's time, but they would be later, and when they were entirely evil, God was going to wipe them out, and he was going to bring in his own people and settle them in the land called Canaan. And the land would be divided up into 12 portions, and the tribe of Levi would not own any territory, but they would be the priests. And they would serve the whole nation as priests, and they would live off the tithes and offerings in the temple, and therefore they wouldn't need any land. So the land is divided up into 12 sectors. Now, God's promise to Abraham was that the people would be slaves for 400 years, and then they would be rescued. And that, of course, happened in the time of Moses. So Genesis 1 to 11 is really just the beginning of things. Genesis 12 to the end is the family of Abraham, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then the next book, Exodus, starts with Moses. And Exodus through to Deuteronomy is all about the time of Moses. And Moses was supposed to do two things. One, get the people out from slavery in Egypt. Two, get them in to the land called Canaan. Getting them out of Egypt happened after a series of miracles, as you probably know. And the last one was a little lamb was slain. It had to be a perfect lamb. Its blood was taken. It was applied in the sign of a cross on the doorway of their homes, the lintel and the two doorposts. So the lamb was killed, and then the destroying angel moved through the land. Every home that didn't have that sign on it, the firstborn of the family was killed, and also the animals. And that night, the children of Israel came out. And as they came out, they were beginning to be free for the first time. There were 2 million of them by that time. Not only had Israel had 12 sons of his own, but his descendants had been pretty busy as well. In a little over 400 years, there were 2 million of them. So here they come out of Egypt. They've got some wealth that has been given to them by the Egyptians, and they're setting off until in front of them they see the waters of the Red Sea. And they'd never seen the sea before, and they were quite excited, maybe, like children at the beach, except they were supposed to cross it, and there weren't any bridges, and there weren't any boats. And just when they got used to seeing the sea in front of them, they looked back, and here was a dust cloud behind them, which was being kicked up by the army of Egypt, the greatest army that the world had ever seen until that time. And the Egyptians were coming after them to take them back into slavery, led by Pharaoh, who was for them the devil incarnate. So here they were, caught between the devil and the deep Red Sea, that's right. And God then opened the waters of the Red Sea, and they went across, and the Egyptians tried to follow, but the waters came back again. Very few people in those days could swim. The Egyptians wore armor, and it's sort of difficult to swim when you're wearing armor. The horses were pulling chariots, and it's difficult to swim when you're pulling a chariot. So they were all drowned, which was bad for their health. And the next day, the people of Israel looked back, and on the shores of the Red Sea, there was wreckage and bodies scattered on the whole length of the beach. And it was evidence of the mighty power of God at work, without even shouting. You know, and without apparently making any effort at all, he just wiped out the mightiest army that the world had ever seen. And they knew that they were free. There was evidence of it there. The sea was now between them and Egypt. They couldn't go back even if they wanted to. They were rescued, liberated forever. And ahead of them were all the promises of God and all the plans that he had for them. So Moses got out a little book, a little box, set it down, stood up on it and faced 2 million people with his PA, and he announced to his 2 million people, "Now take out your hymn books and we're all going to sing number 347. Except he didn't, because they'd forgotten to bring their hymn books with them. Actually, there was a reason for that. They didn't have any hymns. There was even a reason for that. They'd never had anything to sing about when they were slaves. And they didn't know any songs. And they weren't allowed to meet together when they were slaves, of course. They just worked 7 days a week, as long as they had strength to work. When they had no more strength, they crawled back to their hovels and slept. They had no social life. They certainly had no worship life, not as a community anyway, and probably not as individuals, except in a few families where the truth had been passed on. And now God had rescued them, and they did sing, even though they hadn't got an organ, and even though they hadn't got so much as a guitar, and they didn't have any songs, they didn't have any words, and they didn't know any tunes. 2 million people sang, not because it was Sunday morning, because they don't know what day it was, not because it's what they did every day they crossed the Red Sea, because it was fairly unusual in their experience, but they sang because there was a tremendous inner desire to praise God because he had rescued them. And they didn't sing because they were told to sing, and they didn't sing because it was expected of them, and they didn't sing because it was routine. They sang because the praise was already in their hearts. And it's an occasion that I would just love to have experienced. 2 million people all praising God out of a genuine desire to praise him. Now, probably you can look back to a time like that for yourself. A time when you knew for the very first time that God had set you free. That your sins had been wiped out. That you really saw what Jesus Christ had actually done for you when he died for you on the cross. And there was a tremendous desire within your heart to praise him. Not because some minister stood up and told you to, but because you really wanted to. And if you can look back to a time like that, good. If you can't, and you've never known that kind of desire to praise God and worship him with all your being, then very likely you're not a Christian. Almost certain. If you can, is it still like that? Or has something gone wrong? If something's gone wrong, hopefully we'll identify it tonight as we move on to see what happened to these people that God chose to be, first of all, the people who would know him, and second, the people who would show what he's really like.